everybody, to episode 146 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry. I am your host, Jeff Bowdern. They call me the Booker. With me, my man in toasty warm Ambler, PA, the fully head-shaven, fully beard-shaven, Mrs. Bowdern would approve, Lord Berenstrohs. How you doing, Bear?
I'm doing good, Jeff. I am sunburned. I am hot. It is. I was telling
all people, the ladies called you hot, even with the head of hair and beard.
Well, yeah, they called me older. Jeff, how weird is it that for the first time in the last 22 years, I grow hair on my head. I've got a full head of hair. And the majority of people say, you look older now that you have hair. What the fuck is that?
So wanted to give you a chance to know, folks, that we are going to go someplace. Barry, I think we've been there one time before, but it has been a long time since we went down to Mexico. So we are calling on a friend of the show and Lucha Libre expert Roy Lucier to talk about a match that, wow, I can't believe we haven't got to this one before, Barry. Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero, Los Gringos Locos versus Octagon and El Hijo del Santo from the LA Sports Arena, November 6, 1994. Besides that, I'm going to talk about the Andre the Giant book that I just finished, by the way, Bear. Fabulous read. So well researched. So well done. I'm going to tell you about my past Wednesday, which was quite the expensive day for your friend here. We have, based on a request from the board, a courthouse story, Bear. And we are going to be taking a question from one of our readers, Adam. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Adam Dumau.
Jeff, you said 146. We're four episodes away from that magical number of 150 episodes.
Truly.
Wow. What are we going to do, Jeff? What kind of a party? What kind of a celebration? What's going to happen at 100 on the 150th episode?
I'm sure the news will be spread far and wide on the Arcadian Network. There will be some special pronouncement. It won't be ignored. Well, anyway, it might be. I don't know.
It might be.
So anyway, we're going to be now joined by Roy Lucier. Roy, what's going on, my man?
Not much. I just, as we're speaking, I just bought a new home, moving everything in. So just decorating it. Got my own man cave finally, starting to put figures and cabinets and TVs.
I'm guessing there may be one or two videotapes or DVDs in that man cave, Roy.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, probably around 15,000 to 18,000 at this.
Yes, I follow Roy on Twitter, and he posts like every time he gets a new box of videotapes. And it makes me wonder about all those videotapes I used to have that I sent to John McAdam and never saw again. But that's another story for another. So, Roy, we're having you on the show, besides the fact that you're a friend of the show and a great guy. We want to discuss November 6, 1994, the LA Sports Arena, Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero versus Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. I reached out to Roy earlier this week, and I said, hey, were you at the event? He said, not only was I at the event, I was in the first row.
And I got video proof of it.
Yes, holding up the 100% Rudo sign, I believe, I'm sure. Yep. And so I wanted to get a feel from Roy about what it was like to be feet on the ground that night, because Barry, I think we can agree based on the video that we watched this week, that was one crazy damn crowd.
It was too. This was such a great match. And Jeff, we go back, you know, to this match taking place at the end of 1994. And this was a really big deal when it happened. And I remember the tape trading community was just going crazy. How could I get a copy of this? And I completely forgot, as I was watching it this week, the WWE logo is in the top right corner. And I'm like,
Unfortunately, yes.
But then it jarred my memory. This was some sort of joint promotion that
WCW. Yeah.
Yeah. I had completely forgotten about this. I got to tell you, fantastic match. I watched it. The real treasure of this match, I mean, obviously, Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero are just through the roof, and we can talk about them all day. But Mike fucking Tenay is just fantastic. How is Mike Tenay not working in professional wrestling on a regular basis? The guy was gold.
Yes, and he was joined ably, I'm sure everyone will agree, by Chris Cruz. The pay-per-view when worlds collide. So, Roy, you were there. Tell us about that evening. Give us some memories of that night that you had.
All right, so got there, drove in with some friends. I bought the ticket the day the tickets went on sale. I learned my lesson back with La Revancha to always buy your tickets ahead of time for a Triple H show at the Sports Arena because they do sell out. So get to the building. Well, lo and behold, front row. So hold up all my signs, do everything. You know, see a lot of old people there that, you know, I knew. But one thing about the crowd, 99% Mexican. I mean, I could probably count how many white people were there on both my hands and feet. I mean, probably 15, 20 that I saw total. It was not many at all. So first match happens. I believe it was the minis. Went on with, like, I think it was like Chris Benoit and Tito Santana and Tuco Scorpio. And then there was like a the match with like Ray and Psychosis and Louis Spicoli as Madonna's boyfriend and Forza Guerrero and La Parka and all them. And I think there may have been one other match, but the buzz in the building for Eddie and Art was just through the roof. And, you know, the crazy thing is that was Art's last match. He passed away like a little 2 weeks later. He went back to Portland after the match. His head was shaved. He wanted to grow out a little bit or whatever. And, you know, it was crazy. So anyways, the match starts and it was like a pretty much an easy first fall for Art and Eddie. And I don't know if this was on camera or not. I don't know if I've watched it since on video, but there is Art and Eddie are looking at the crowd and they're saying, yes, 187. And the reason for that being was there was a prop 187 at the time that was on the ballot in California that if it had went through, it would have denied people that didn't work, citizens of the state of California, access to like hospitals, their kids to the school, medical stuff, whatever. So it was a pretty hotbed topic. So Art and Eddie were just egging the crowd on with the 187.
That's real heel stuff, man.
Yeah. Not only that, and I don't know if this is on camera or not too, but Art and Eddie are on the ground swimming.
Yes, that I saw at the beginning of the thing.
Because what they're insinuating is the only way that if you got here from Mexico that you got to America, you did it by swimming. So it was
completely inappropriate and horrible, but I absolutely busted out laughing when I saw that. Yeah. Which I should be ashamed of, I know.
So second fall starts, and you know, it's an amazing match. And I forgot, I think it was, they got the pin on Santo or something like that. So it was down to Octagon. And I'll tell you this, I'm looking around and there was like a prison riot's about to break off. You could feel the tension in the air. And I had a bag next to me with some figures in it, and masks and all that stuff. And I looked down and I kept a visual of it because I was ready to get my bag and get the hell out of there because a white person in the building, if Eddie and Art had won, they would have lynched, charged the ring, lynched any white guy in sight, especially the idiot white guy in the front row with the 100% Rudo sign. So I've
been the first choice.
Yeah, I literally, because, you know, in the past, I was like their first choice. So I think Octagon gets the pin, and, you know, in a Lucha style 2 out of 3 falls match, you don't just got to pin one guy, you got to pin both guys. So he gets the pin on Art or Eddie and then, you know, gets the pin on the other one. Goes into the third fall, and I mean, that third fall was just a thing of beauty. That was just insane how good the match was. It was like not just Rudo versus Technico type stuff. They just put it all on the line. You know, all four wrestlers were showing how technical they could be, and Art and Eddie did a dive right in front of me, and it just the whole match was great, and they ended up getting the pin. And when I think, Blue Panther came in there and did the Martinette on a Love Machine. And that was one of the hugest pops I've ever heard in my entire life was when he did the Martinette. Because in Mexico, the tombstone, the Martinette or the pile driver is a banned move. So he did it behind the
ref. Great, just a real subtle thing is Art sold it like he was knocked out. But when he finally came to, the ring mics catch him going, where am I?
Yeah.
Which I just thought that was so great. And it's such a guy that's been, you know, you can say what you want. I know Art had problems in the past that led to him really being demonized by a lot of the wrestling community. But wow, when you see something like that, you know, that's a guy that's been raised in the wrestling industry, you know, and just something that seemingly is so subtle, but it's so great. Like, where am I? You know,
yeah.
It's completely selling the move.
Absolutely. And I mean, from there, it was like you really couldn't top that. Conan and Perro had their cage match at that point. And I mean, it was okay and did the trick and stuff like that. But, you know, just that I've been to probably over 2000 live events in my life. And anytime someone asks me, what's the greatest live match you've ever seen? I always say Santo and Octagon against Eddie and Art. That was a masterpiece from beginning to end. And, you know, one thing too, and I want to say this, is they had a match a year earlier for the Mexican National Parejas tag team title. And that match is seriously just as good. So I forgot the name of the city, but it's November 93. And I know it's on YouTube and Daily Motion because I have it on there. Check that out too. And I know we're talking about when's Worlds Collide, but I just want to let everyone know those teams had history. And that was a very long history because of the whole Eddie and Art turning heel. Especially it was considered by the fans because Eddie and Santo were a tag team, Nuevo Pareja Atomica, the new atomic pair. And when Eddie turned on Santo, it was like the Mexicans felt like Eddie turned his back on Mexico. So it was a nice, long, drawn-out feud that obviously culminated with that. And who knows what they would have had planned after that. But unfortunately, Art passed away a couple weeks later.
Okay, so lots of because I know that you know so much about the history of Lucha. Just to give the folks context, obviously, the original El Santo and Eddie's dad, Gory, were part of a huge tag team in Mexico, correct?
Yes. They were called the Atomic Pair, Pareja Atomica.
Okay, so that's what led to Hijo de Santo and Eddie becoming partners. Now, Eddie, of course, originally wore a mask. And what was his name?
Máscara Mágica.
Okay, and then he unmasked voluntarily, which was very, very rare, correct?
Yes. So okay. Eddie started, you know, teaming with the Guerreros and stuff like that. And then CMLL brought him in either late 91 or early 92 as Máscara Mágica. And then in late 92, he debuted for AAA. But before the match even started, I know it was Máscara Sagrada and Octagon were his partners. They said they had an announcement for the crowd. And they announced that Máscara Mágica would be voluntarily taking off his mask. And he is Eddie Guerrero. And, you know, it was a big deal because I can't think of anyone that's ever voluntarily taken their mask off without losing it in a stipulation match.
Now, Art, if I'm not mistaken, originally came in as the American Love Machine under Hood, right?
Yes. Yes.
And then he lost the match to who? To lose the
Blue
match.
Blue Panther.
Okay. Which was part of the storyline where when Blue Panther came in the ring, that was part of their whole storyline too, Blue Panther getting revenge on Art. So I'm sitting here stepping all over things. Barry, did you have any questions you want to ask him about the match?
No, this is good too. So, hey, just a quick question when it comes to Art Barr also. I know that this was his last match. What was the official cause of death? Was it drug-related or was it just a heart condition? Roy, do you remember?
I don't remember. I mean, he was in his late 20s, so it had to be something drug-related. I mean, if someone's got Google, can look it up, although we know that's not always trustworthy, but it had to be an overdose or something, or, you know, I don't remember.
I remember vaguely the story was, and this is going back to reading it in the Observer, you know, almost 30 years ago at this point, or 26 years ago, but like he was lying in bed with his kids and they all went to sleep and he didn't wake up. It was something like that, but it was a bizarre, but what a talent though, Roy. So when you're watching this match and you're watching Eddie Guerrero, and Eddie Guerrero, obviously at this stage, the guy was one of the elite workers, but he really hadn't made the name for himself yet.
No.
Could you, as you're watching this, I mean, do you see that you've got, you know, and had he not passed, Art Barr probably would have been a gigantic star. Do you see future worldwide superstars as you're watching this match?
Yeah, because I think that Paul Heyman would have brought Eddie and Art in together, you know, for, I guess, Public Enemy and Sabu and Taz, and, you know, just kind of showcase what they were about. And this is not a knock on Eddie whatsoever, but, you know, it's obviously why it's associated with him. Most people think Eddie was the one who created the frog splash. It was actually Art. And after Art passed away, Eddie started doing the frog splash as a tribute to Art. So a lot of people see the frog splash and they're like, oh, that's Eddie Guerrero's move. It's actually Art Barr who came up with the move.
That's good stuff. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's why we brought Roy on the show, people.
That's it. There you go.
So you mentioned that this is the greatest match you've ever seen live.
Yes.
So I want to ask you, because you've been to 2,000 matches and I know that the majority of that, correct me if I'm wrong, are lucha matches in the LA area in Mexico. Compare the intensity of the crowd that night to other shows that you've been to.
It was an overall fun atmosphere, but, you know, the second that Eddie and Art started getting the heat, you know, with the swimming and the 187 stuff, you know, that it really turned from a jovial, happy crowd to, you know, they wanted the guys' heads on a platter. I mean, I've been to a lot of lucha shows where, you know, you just got a lot of people that really still take what they see as legitimate sport and are very vocal and passionate about it. So
that's a terrible question to ask.
What's that?
How many of the people that go to Lucha Libre shows, you know, the famous clip of the guy from Mid-Atlantic, it's still real to me, damn it.
Oh yeah. Dave Wills.
Yeah. How many people that go to the Lucha Libre shows, like the people at this show, believe that it was real?
As opposed to,
you know, people that go to WWE or used to go to WCW, you know, 50% of them were smart marks at that point. But did they still believe it was real at that point?
Nowadays, it's maybe 50-50, but back then it was probably 80-90%.
Okay. I mean, I'm just curious. So, Barry, why don't you tell us? I don't think we ever got you. What did you think of the match? And before you start, let me just say that after I watched the match and Barry hadn't watched it, I texted him and I said, the match is complete chaos, but in a really good way. So
yeah, that's a very accurate description of the match as well. It is chaotic, but there's this electricity. And again, you've got Art Barr, Love Machine, Los Gringos Locos, Eddie Guerrero. I think you got two of the best workers in the U.S. at that time. And two guys, too, that really weren't on, you know, a big stage on a routine basis. So in watching them, and, you know, Roy just made a great point. Paul Heyman bringing them into ECW would have been fantastic. But was there a better tag team in the U.S. at this moment? And granted, when we say U.S., look, they were working Mexico primarily. But was there a better tag team? That there wasn't. This was at a different level of what we're seeing. Mike Tenay and Chris Cruz. Now, I have been so critical of Chris Cruz because he really is a raging asshole on social media. He really is. Look, he's a mean-spirited prick. But at the same time, he does a really good job here, I think. And I think, in all fairness, you know, again, I've trashed this guy. He does a really good job with Mike Tenay. And I think the combination of he and Tenay was fantastic. Mike Tenay, as I'm listening to this, literally within the first 3 or 4 minutes, he's tossing out trivia facts that nobody does. And occasionally, Mauro Ranallo will do it. Sometimes Nigel McGuinness will do it on NXT. But for the most part, you don't get this. But Mike Tenay, 3 out of 4 are all second-generation wrestlers, only Octagon not being the second-generation wrestler. El Santo, the star of 44 movies in his native Mexico. I just thought, and then Jeff, the big one here for me, this was huge. Octagon is named for the Chuck Norris movie.
Yes.
Octagon.
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, that's like gold. Yes, exactly. Mike Tenay, how are you now? I know you're working at a casino in Vegas now, right? Isn't he working at a casino, Roy?
He's retired. He's actually taking time off. He's got two homes. He goes, you know, with the whole virus issue, he's going in between his homes, visits one of his homes outside of Nevada once a month. And that's when he sends out boxes of goodies to me. And the other time, he's just in Nevada, just enjoying retirement. He's gotten a lot of offers to come back and do things, you know, announcing podcasts and stuff like that. And he's really enjoying his time away right now.
Which is smart as well, too. But what a talent this is. And in this match, I mean, both these guys really shine, too, in this match. So seeing Santo do the job, and I always, you know, I don't necessarily recall this, but when one member of the team loses for the fall to count, both members of the team have to get pinned. So yes. Santo does the job. Yeah, exactly. Which is, it's a little odd to see it, but Santo does the job on the first fall, then Octagon right after. And then in the second fall, Santo gets pinned, but Octagon does not. So that fall doesn't count. Octagon then comes back. He pins Eddie. Then he makes Art Barr submit. The ending is absolutely chaotic. Octagon is stretchered out, and this is where El Santo just goes crazy. They wind up winning the match, meaning that Los Gringos Locos have to get their heads shaved. Now, it's not really, I think we can say it's not really a head shaving because there are no clippers, but it's essentially, were there clippers?
At the end of the show in the locker room, they show them getting the rest of their head shaved. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a famous Bob Barnett video of them backstage, and I mean, the guys got their head shaved completely.
Yeah, they just did the mullets ring. In the ring.
Yeah, exactly. The mullets were gone, and it was odd because Eddie's screaming at Art, cut my hair, cut the hair, just do it. And they're cutting off the mullets. But this is as good a match as, and this was a period where I had stopped watching Lucha Libre. I had watched a few years earlier, big fan of Blue Panther, big fan of Octagon. And we used to get it in South Florida. It was like Sunday nights around 7 o'clock, and it was CMLL. Yeah, I think it was Channel 23, and it was great, and I used to record it. But this kind of makes me want to start watching Lucha Libre, not necessarily the current stuff, but going back to the early 90s. So maybe we can start to pick out some matches from Mexico, Jeff, from the glory days, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying to put up as much as possible from, so like a lot of the stuff that the man that I just mentioned has been sending me, there's a lot, because he had a satellite dish. Or he asked Rick Carter to help him film off of a satellite dish. And there's a lot of stuff here, XCQ feed, that was not shown on Galavision or the other one, Televisa. So, I mean, there's a lot of rare matches on here that from that glory period, including stuff with, like, you know, Ray, Juventud, Psicosis, Santo, that is just unbelievable to see so many years later how smooth they were in the ring and how many light years ahead of everyone else that they were.
Okay, wanted to thank Lou for finding out on Wikipedia. Art Barr, quote, died under unknown circumstances, but had a mixture of alcohol and drugs in his bloodstream. Thanks for that, Lou. So let me just offer a couple things real quick, and then I have a question for you. So one of the things I told Barry that I found absolutely hilarious is when Octagon is being stretchered out, taken back to the locker room, and I don't know if it was Tanay or Cruz says, oh, my God, today is such a horrible day. Look, Octagon is being stretchered out. And we just found out the news today that President Reagan is suffering from the early onset of Alzheimer's, which I just thought was perfect for a pay-per-view about Lucha Libre. It was just hilarious. I wanted to say that whether you liked him or not, Luis Piccoli, Madonna's boyfriend is the greatest gimmick name in the history of wrestling. I love that. You know, we discussed the feud that had happened between Art and Blue Panther. But Roy, tell me, why was Octagon part of this match? Like, what was his, what was the angle that put Octagon that, as opposed to Blue Panther?
Well, Octagon was like the number two in the company. So, okay. I mean, there's a lot of things that, like, I want to see a few months after that, March of 95, AAA brought in, they repackaged, I think it was Espanto Jr., and they brought him in as Santo Negro. And for 2-3 weeks on TV, Santo Negro was this big heel that was going to feud with Santo. Well, Santo's family sued AAA because they own the rights to the Santo name, and they said it was actually detrimental to Santo to have a character, even parody of it or anything similar to it. So in order to get around legalities, they changed Santo Negro over to Pentagon to feud with Octagon. And Octagon was already the number two in the company, but behind Hijo de Santo. And that feud just escalated Octagon light years, even beyond Santo at that point, because the hot new villain for him to fight and stuff like that. Octagon was always like popular with the kids, had the figures, would do the commercials. He was just considered a team player. And even up until, I believe, other than the referee, Pepe Casas, Octagon was the only employee that had been with AAA from day one. And he left like, I think, 2011 or 2012. So, I mean, he was considered a lifetime employee of them. And in doing so, he was rewarded with many big matches within the company. So that's why how he got in there was just by default. He was, you know, the best person to team with Santo. And why it wasn't Santo and Blue Panther versus Eddie and Art, I'm going to assume just because, like, over the past year, that from that title match, because Santo and Octagon were originally the Mexican national tag team title holders, and Eddie and Art beat them for it. So it was just a 1 year.
Okay, period. No, that's fair enough. I didn't know if there was a specific angle that I didn't know about leading up to that, you know, that pulled Octagon into the series or what. Just as we close out talking about the match, amazing, amazing crowd. We've talked so much on this show before about how the crowd reaction and the crowd being so viscerally into a match just adds so much. And definitely in this case, the hatred for Art and Eddie. And by the way, let me just say that Eddie may have had the greatest mullet in the history of the world before the haircutting in this. It's, you know, the fact his mullet's bleached, it's just absolutely amazing. But go out of your way. We'll, of course, post this match in our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. And I'm glad Roy was able to join us to talk about this match as someone who was there, especially to provide the remembrance of the visceral reaction from the crowd. Hopefully, Roy, you didn't get anyone throwing urine on you that night as you
No.
have you had before. So before we let Roy go, and we talked to him before we started recording about this, Roy recently, unfortunately, he was involved with the Cauliflower Alley Club, and he had to resign his position. And we wanted to, I didn't want to sandbag Roy and bring this up without talking about him. So he knows we're going to address this issue. Roy, you recently resigned your position with the CAC.
Yes.
And wanted to give you the microphone and let you talk about the events that led to your resignation and talk about some things going on with the CAC right now.
Okay. So basically a year and a half ago, Scott Teal got me into Cauliflower Alley as a social media administrator, meaning I was in charge of the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And the thing with it too was I got to be pretty close to Brian Blair, talk to him all the time. When an award winner would be nominated, he would give me a call and, you know, double run it just to make sure, like, for example, a certain award, you have to have a legitimate background, and he would call me to make sure that the person had a legitimate background and not a worked background, or a Lucha award, and make sure the person was actually a luchador. So I had been doing it for a year and a half, and thing with it is I work for a living as a medical courier, and I drive 10 to 12 hours a day. So I can't always give all the attention to it that I wanted to. So sometimes I was getting one post a day. Sometimes I would get an inbox that somebody passed away, and I would, you know, kind of pull over and, you know, post about it and try to do stuff like that. But earlier this year, back in the middle of March, obviously the COVID pandemic stuff started, and we pushed the event from April into September. Well, a couple weeks ago, I got an inbox from Dan Farron. He's just like, hey, are you guys actually going to run CAC? And I was thinking, well, why not? I hadn't been following the news because I'd been so busy with work, but apparently the numbers have started surging again in Nevada and Las Vegas especially. So I got a hold of Brian, and Brian said, well, okay, I'll get a hold of the casino. Got a hold of the casino, and the casino told him, well, part of your contract says that if you're within 90 days of the event and you try to postpone, cancel, do anything, that you forfeit the down deposit for the event, which I believe was $52,000 or $53,000, one of the two. The problem at that point, however, was because a few people started being very vocal that CAC did not have every member's interest in heart and tried to make it political based on some earlier posts earlier in the year by Brian Blair. And that's in no way, shape, or form where we trying to dismiss or make anyone feel like we didn't care about their concerns. But nobody bothered to call Brian Blair up to ask him, hey, what's going on? Or the Brian Blair would have shared with them, if we postpone the event, we lose the deposit. What we need to do is we need to wait for the city, state, or casino to cancel the event, and then we will run it another time. So it just got really, really ugly. That day and the next day, people were tagging CAC, and a couple of the comments were along the lines of, Dominic DiNucci is in his 80s, and you guys are going to kill him. And by the way, I hope the same thing happens to you and your family for running the event.
Okay, Roy, hold on 1 second. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I want to address that particular issue. But before we do, I want to bring Barry in at this point, because Barry you had almost the exact same experience with the CWF Legends Fan Fest. And that was part of the concern with you and David Penzer, Cash Home, Cash Money, with the deposits and all that. And that's what led to the problems with you having to cancel the CWF Legends Fan Fest, correct?
Yeah. So we actually, our situation was even a little more fucked up because we were underneath the umbrella of the World Wrestling Network, which has since been purchased by the WWE. So we actually couldn't even cancel our own event. The World Wrestling Network had to do it. But for them to do it, they would have been out, I don't know, $100,000, some crazy number, because they had paid for the building, they had paid talent, there was trans, there was all this involved. So we had to sit back with our hands completely tied and we couldn't do anything. And I kept saying to Cash Money, we need to cancel this. And he said, we can't. It's not up to us. It's up to the World Wrestling Network.
Okay. So Roy, I'm sorry I interrupted. Please continue.
Okay. So basically it got really ugly with the social media stuff. About 3 or 4 people that were just like ripping CAC, thinking we didn't care about, the old timers especially. And this is something I'm very passionate about is, I have seen firsthand the amount of wrestlers that, especially in a time like this, where a lot of them aren't working and bills need to be paid and they're reaching out to CAC and we're helping them. The CAC is something I'm very passionate about because I've seen in my time there, the dozens of wrestlers that they have helped out personally. So unfortunately, when those social media posts started going, people don't realize every position in CAC is voluntarily. You don't get a salary for it. You're not paid for it. You have to pay your own air trans, hotel, all that stuff. The best you can do is that you can write it off on your taxes, is that you work for a nonprofit and at tax time, X amount for the ticket, the hotel, the trans, all that, and you could write it off. That's the best you can do, which I'm happy with it. I was going to plan on going anyway, so, it helps. But once threats start coming in, no, I'm dropping out. So I texted Brian Blair the next morning and told him that I'd be resigning and got a hold of Meltzer, and I let him know as well, as he's been pretty helpful. Before I got the position, I asked him and he was like, oh yeah, that'd be good for you, especially as much as you're on social media. So I just let Brian know, and then I announced the following Monday after getting my head on a little straight that I would be resigning my position. And I guess the same day they gave it over to Bob Cook. Now, the thing with Bob Cook is he is retired. He doesn't have a job. He can post all day long, which I see he has been doing, by the way, is he posts multiple times a day with themes like Brody Day, Terry Funk Day, stuff like that. And, it's better anyway. He's probably posted more in one day than I did in the last month. So by all means, I still support Cauliflower Alley. I still support Brian Blair. There's just a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. I just wish people know that we really do have the wrestler's best interests at heart. And there was no ill intent with not postponing the event. It was something that once the numbers started to surge, we called the casino and attempted to do, and we were just told no. But now that there's starting to be more restrictions, I believe the loophole that got them to postpone it was that no event could have more than 50 people inside of a room. And that basically takes all the honorees and CAC out. We can't sell any tickets for the event.
Roy, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, so it does seem like it's a very small group of people that we're targeting and criticizing the CAC. So it isn't like it's, 200 people. It really does appear to be, 5 to 10 people max.
Yes.
What do you think the motivation is? Is it a personal attack when it comes to Brian Blair? In your mind, and I'm speculating on this, what do you think that people are angry about? What is it specifically?
I mean, there were some people, and Blue Meanie's one of them, who said, I do believe CAC needs to be canceled. Please do the right thing. That were very respectful about it and tagged CAC. And those posts were very appreciated. It was just the other ones were all, like, I'm not going to get political on the show in any way, shape, or form, but Brian Blair's political leaning was constantly brought up. And well, since he votes for, political whatever, he obviously thinks that this virus is bullshit, not real, and he wants these people killed. And it just became more of a political issue than just looking at the bigger picture. And it just that.
Well, let me just say, Roy, that, once this story got out, I'll be honest, and private conversations that Barry and I had, Barry was the first to point out to me, this is exactly what happened with me and Penzer in Tampa, you know, but you know, maybe it's apples and oranges because of the whole involvement of the network. But he said, I know exactly why they can't cancel it yet. It's because they're going to completely lose the deposit, which is the same thing that Penzer and I were facing. So we wanted to give you a chance to talk about what was going on. We wanted to bring you on once we decided we were going to do this, the match with Art and Eddie. And because I know you're one of the go-to people, I hope people are appreciative of the fact that you are like one of the caretakers of the history of Lucha Libre. And, you know, I for one, because I'm not a regular watcher of Lucha Libre, as Barry said, maybe we should start paying attention to more of the matches from this particular era, because there were a lot of great matches. But, you know, I hope people are appreciative of the job that you and guys like Bob Barnett and I know Kurt Brown are very respectful and appreciative of the history of Lucha Libre. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. And if I didn't mention your name, I'm sorry.
Another guy, too, for those out there, he's on Twitter under the name Rob Viper. His real name's Rob Bihari. That guy is a freaking encyclopedia when it comes to Lucha. I believe he works for High Spot, so he's got some connections with them and helps out with Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. But he's based out of Toronto, and his Twitter is basically 90% Lucha, in all in English, but he is bilingual. He's got some great connections and stuff like that. So
of course, I have to ask you, what the hell ever happened to Steve Sims?
You know what? I'd like to know that myself. From Dr. what Lucha. I know, Dan Farron got a hold of Steve's sister, and we know that Steve lives in Vegas. We know that much. We were trying to get him out for Cauliflower Alley, but we hadn't heard back from him. And, you know, there's been some wacky stories about Sims.
Oh, yeah. last I heard of Steve Sims, he rented a car in Chicago.
Yeah. I heard that, and I'm just like, wait, what? Because, you know, back in 91, 92, 93, 94, Sims had a newsletter called Lucha Libre Weekly. And that was the great, like, as someone that was like 17 years old when I got a hold of it, I just ate that up and read that from beginning to end, got all the back issues. Sims helped me, like, say, on the satellite dish where you can tune in and get
Lucha. He was the guy that Meltzer went to get stories
about
Lucha.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, Sims was the man, and I would really like to know it. I know in 94 he moved out to Pomona or something like that, and he actually came to a couple Lucha shows that I was at and actually, you know, sat down with him and stuff like that and met him at the shows. And I know he did some episodes of Fredo Esparza's podcast about 2-3 years ago, Lucha World. And then all of a sudden he just fell off the face of the earth.
Funny how that happens, because if you look at back issues of the Observer from like the 80s and into the early 90s, you'll see names that, you know, guys I remember seeing all the time. And you go like, what the hell ever happened to that guy?
Yeah. Steve Minari, you know.
Yeah. Well, the big question, even Dave doesn't know this, is the guy that used to do the illustrations for the old Observer yearbooks was Mr. Mike, who lived and was based out of Minnesota and completely disappeared off the face of the earth after the WWF expansion. So anyway, Roy, listen, we want to say thank you so much for educating not only Barry and myself about Lucha Libre and this particular pay-per-view, but our listeners also. And we'd love to have you back on again if we have another Lucha match in the future, my man.
No, absolutely. And for those out there, my Twitter inbox is always open. If you don't have Twitter, I have Facebook too. If you ever have any questions about Lucha Libre, you need some where to go and, you know, some suggestions on some great matches from over the years, please always feel free to reach out to me, because I love Lucha as passionate as can be. You know, Lucha has done a lot for me over the years. It's given me like a second home. When I went down to Mexico, finally, for the first time this March, so many of the wrestlers that I knew reached out to me. Then I had dinner with them, and, you know, I got into a lot of shows and finally got to Arena Mexico and stuff like that. And it's like, it's really been like another family to me. You know, it's taught me Spanish over the years. It's just opened a lot of doors. And, you know, they're very thankful for its existence and the people that are in it.
Yeah, I know Barry got a chance to go down to Arena Mexico within the last year, right, Bear?
No, I think it was like 2 years ago. It was right before we started the podcast. And I think, Roy, you and I were actually in touch when I was going down there. And
we were supposed to do the anniversary show, and then all of a sudden the virus hit, and, you know, we had to go back.
Yeah, it was a come to Jesus moment for me, because it was just being in that arena is just so exciting. Just everything A to Z about it. That was such a great experience. And I got to tell you, once this is over, it's been my goal. Get back out to Los Angeles, then get down to Mexico to see wrestling again.
The best place in the world. I really believe that, you know, even more than Budokan or Corican Hall, Arena Mexico, it's a holy ground. It really is.
Roy, once again, thanks for joining us, buddy. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
We want to again thanks Roy Lucier for coming in and talking about the match. Lots of great info about Lucha Libre. Roy, just a great guy.
He really is. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when the news broke that people were threatening him because of the CAC. And I think what really got me angry, you know, I understood Brian Blair can be extremely political, and there has been almost a witch hunt based either off of his political beliefs or, you know, the fact that he had a run-in with a couple of very prominent wrestling fans. But at the same time, fucking Roy has done nothing but be good to everybody. The guy posts all this content for free. We're talking thousands of videos. He's dedicated his life. He's like this super fan that is just super passionate, and he's just a really good guy. And you can't say that about a lot of people. So I was really disheartened when I heard that, but I'm glad he was able to come on today, kind of talk about it a little bit. And again, you know, for us, this was, he dropped some great knowledge regarding Lucha Libre on us, Jeff. I really, really enjoyed his segment.
Yeah, great guy. So Barry wanted to mention that I have now finished the Andre the Giant book by Bertrand Hébert and Pat LaPrade, The Eighth Wonder of the World. Barry, I can't recommend this book enough. Not only is it a good read, you don't get as much as they give you content and detail, which is incredible. It's not a book where you ever stop because you're just like, okay, this is getting a little heavy on content. Some of the stuff about his early career in Europe, France and in England and stuff like that is really, really interesting stuff that I didn't know about. Of course, once he gets to the United States, it becomes more stuff that's common knowledge, but you also get background there. I did want to tell you one story that I just found particularly funny. Of course, we remember, if you're a longtime fan, the famous angle where Killer Khan, I want to say this is about 80 or 81, where Killer Khan, quote unquote, breaks Andre's ankle, and Andre is out, you know, having surgery. And it's the only time up to that point that Andre had ever been injured. So it was a huge deal. And Killer Khan was, by the way, just a great opponent for Andre. Of course, Barry, you remember the time frame I'm talking about here?
Oh, yeah. You're looking early 80s right there, but I remember that.
Okay. So Andre, who legitimately had broken his ankle, goes to the doctor, okay? And the doctor asks Andre, what happened? You know, how'd you break your ankle? Because obviously you have broken your ankle. Now, Andre, obviously, because of the acromegalia and everything else, this was really what led to it was, you know, he was outgrowing his own body. It's absolutely a tragic story. And trust me, when you get to the end of the story, his life is, you know, as he was like this, like one of the world's most famous people who was trapped inside this body that was growing exponentially. And, you know, the rest of his body couldn't keep up. It's really a very tragic story. And the fact that he just died alone in a hotel room. But anyway, this part was particularly funny, I thought. So, of course, Andre's protecting the business, right? And he knows they're going to do an angle that involves Killer Khan having broken his ankle. So he tells the doctor, oh, I broke it in Western New York. Well, how'd you break it? Killer Khan broke my ankle. When actually what happened was Andre was getting up out of bed and, you know, set up in bed, stepped up out of bed, and he heard a crack. Well, of course, that doesn't sell tickets. So to his own doctor, he kayfabed and created this storyline that it was Killer Khan awesome. That had broken his ankle. It's just fucking awesome. I'm sorry.
That
I
is
just,
awesome.
I love stories about guys like that that protected the business. So Barry, real quick, people have reached out and asked about, you know, and I discussed in great detail getting through the cancer and all that. Now, post chemo and all that, I have to tell you about my day the other day. So I get out of the hospital on a week ago. Well, this will come out on Tuesday. Let's say a week ago, Saturday, I get out of the hospital. My wife and I stop and we actually get chicken wings. You know, my appetite's very fluctuating. But the point is, I had chicken wings no problems whatsoever. So I wake up on Sunday. I got a slight toothache. Okay. And so I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe I was grinding my teeth, something. It's kind of weird. Let's see, give it a day or two, see if it goes away. And progressively, as the Sunday turns into Monday to Tuesday, my tooth is starting to bother me more. And, you bite into something and all of a sudden it's like, you get that when you've got a huge cavity or something like that, that shock that goes through your skull. Well, it just so happened that my son had a dental appointment for that Wednesday. And so my wife says, look, he's the first appointment of the day there. Why don't you let me call and see if they can get you in just for a consultation, a first visit. Maybe they can do an x-ray. So we plan to do that. Now, while that was going on, I want to say on Monday, Kim says to me, your skin on your forehead, and this is, I'm sure, a chemo thing or post-chemo thing, your skin on your head, your forehead looks really dry. You should put some lotion on it. So before I go to bed, I put a little, Jergens or something like that on my scalp just to see if I can moisturize a little bit. Because, of course, guys like to moisturize, Barry. I'm sure you can appreciate that.
Jergens.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're sitting down, you're watching like porn now with your tissues and your Jergens.
No, it's outside, And that may be another story for another time. I'll just say that. Anyway, so the next day I wake up and Kim's getting ready to go to work. And she goes, hey, your face, it looks like it's broken out a little bit, but it's still dry. Well, as fate would have it, I, for Christmas this year, had gotten Mrs. Bowdrin a gift certificate to get the facial and the nail treatment, one of those day spa things. And because of the pandemic and stuff like that, Mrs. Bowdrin had never used this day spa treatment thing. So she goes and gets her facial and, they do the moisturizer and stuff like that. So, of course, they give her the free samples because they're trying to get her to come back. So she comes home and she says, it still looks like your skin's kind of dry. I should put some of this moisturizer on your forehead and on the top of your head because it still looks like it's really dry. Knock yourself out. So my wife puts the moisturizer and, and all that on my face. She comes home from this was in the morning. She comes home at night and she goes, what the hell happened to your face? And I go, what are you talking about? I hadn't spent moments, a few minutes in front of the mirror all day. I said, what are you talking about? I go and I look in the mirror and my face is, it looks like I got friggin' leprosy. And I go, what the hell did you do to my face? Well, the next morning is the day of the dental appointment, right? So I go there and I'm sitting in the dentist chair. I turn and I look at myself in the mirror and I go, oh my God. It's just like, I have like this giant rash all over the top of my face. Obviously I'm having some sort of allergic reaction, to whatever she gave me or whatever I'd put on before. So I'm texting her and I go, what the fuck happened to my face? I go, it looks like I have leprosy while I'm sitting here in the dentist chair. And so I'm like sitting there apologizing to the dental assistant. I go, I don't know what the hell's going on with my face, but obviously I'm having some sort of allergic reaction. So Kim's texting me, go get some hydrocortisone cream at like Walgreens or CVS or something on the way home. So now the dentist comes in. So number one, I got the issue with my face. Number two, now let's find out what's going on with my tooth, right? Are you with me so far?
Oh, yeah.
So the dentist comes in, he's taking a look, they've taken some x-rays. And I said, so doc, what's going on? I said, is this like, I just like jammed my teeth together or something. And in 2 days, it's going to be gone or what? He looks at the x-ray and apparently it had a root canal here before. And I don't know, I had a crown or something like that there. And he says, now what you got there is you've got a tooth that's cracked at the root.
Oh.
And I said, what does that mean? And he goes, it's going to have to be removed. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, he's just going to talk about the crown. No, not the crown. Because, of course, there's still a tooth underneath that crown. And I'm like, oh. And Barry, dare I ask, have you ever had a tooth extracted?
I have, Jeff. Oh, I have.
Yes, it's tons of fun for the listeners.
Two times. Yes, twice.
And I'm not just, and I'm trying to think. I know I had my wisdom teeth removed. I'm not sure if I've had another one that's actually been.
Can I tell you the worst part about having a tooth removed? So it's not a pain thing because your mouth is going. So I had one removed in February. And then I had one removed about 2.5 years ago. And the worst part is, and again, it's not the pain because they fill you up with the pain reliever. I don't know if it's Novocaine or something similar. But it's the fact that when they go to extract a tooth, Jeff, it's not an immediate extraction. Yeah. It takes 5 minutes. It takes 10 minutes. It takes 15 minutes. There's this twisting and pulling.
Yes.
And you, yeah, and you feel well, the
and not only that, because it's not an entire tooth. Remember, I have a crown there. So right. What's left is only part of my tooth. So, yeah, that's going to be good times, you know.
No, it's so, not. It's not. Not
so anyway, so now the dentist says, all right, well, you know, like whenever you're ready to do this, let us know. We'll set an appointment for you. So now I'm here with the dental assistant, okay? And she's pulling up the figures, and she's like, okay, you go to the front desk. They'll check you out, and they'll give you an idea of what this is going to cost. Mind you, I've just finished with chemo, and we get the bills for chemo, and Mrs. Bowder and I know what we're facing there. At which point they give me the proposed bill for the extraction, and then there's a period where you basically have to let the what's left, what do you call the hole in your mouth? There has to be a healing process before they can go in and whether they put a bridge in or whether they put an implant in, and then I look at the bottom line, Barry. And by the way, this is after insurance. After insurance, I just want to mention that. $4,000, Barry, that Mrs. Bowder and I have to come up with for this tooth. So as I texted you that day, until the foreseeable future, I will be enjoying the benefits of Percocet and or extra strength Tylenol. Oh, and wait a minute. There's one more thing. Because of my chemo treatment, my oncologist, of course, has to be consulted. I don't meet with him until this coming Friday. So I basically have to eat it here as far as the pain goes. But I cannot get any sort of surgery, even of a dental nature, until my oncologist tells me that my white blood cell count is high enough where they can do quote unquote invasive surgery. Boom! That was my Wednesday, people. Tell me how yours was.
I think mine was better. I don't know what I did, Jeff, but it couldn't have been.
I
couldn't
think have if been you were on the toilet all day, it would have been a better day.
Yeah. And there was a day. I forget what day that was. I don't know if it was Wednesday. So here's something that so you and I were talking about this earlier in the week when we weren't recording. And the question I think I asked you was, and because in my head I'm going, $4,000's a lot. And the truth is that there's no even my dental bills. They're through the roof. It's, you know, even if insurance takes care of part of it, you're still looking at a lot of money. But I wonder if your tooth, if they had been weakened by the chemotherapy.
No, and that's a very fair question. And my wife has asked that. And that's a question that I'll be asking my oncologist, because I wonder, too, if that hasn't played a part in it. You know,
yeah,
you know, the chemo poison going in your body to fight a poison. And certainly that may have played a part in it. And again, this is not something where. You know, you have like where you break a tooth a lot of times, you know, when I was in my 20s, I broke a tooth and I remember I was biting a piece of candy and I hear this crack and I was like, oh, that's not good. And, you know, immediately you've done something. And, you know, but this was even the chicken wings that I had the night before. It wasn't like I bit into a bone and went, oh, fuck. It was the weirdest thing waking up with that toothache. Yeah. So I'll keep you posted on my dental issues, Barry. So anyway, we had a post on the page, on our Facebook page the other day that kind of sparked a story. We haven't had a good courthouse story here in a while, Barry. And someone was asking a question. It might have been Adam that we're going to discuss later in the episode here about whether or not I had a good story about the Two Live Crew story that happened at the Broward County story. It was a fact. I remember the person had asked a question. Said, can we ask Barry a courthouse story?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, I can.
I can tell stories about my days as a waiter at the Tavern on the Green in New York City.
We should do a flip on this, Jeff, where one day we just decide we're just going to bullshit through an episode more than usual.
Exactly.
And I'll create
we're
some
good at that.
we're great at that. I'll create some cord stories. You come up with some food service stories about New York City, and let's see how much fun we could have with this.
Yeah,
I think so, it was Adam, actually. I think it was Adam who has gone back, discovered us. He actually, here's the interesting thing, Jeff, and I actually remember this. He joined my CWF group, and he saw the post there about you fighting cancer and decided to go and listen to an episode without having any backstory or any context, decided to go and listen to an episode.
Probably asked, what the fuck have I gotten myself into?
Pretty much, but I guess we hooked him after a couple of episodes. He is in chronological order going through the first episode, and I think he's up to like 55 or 60 at this point, which is real dedication. Yeah, so we're getting these mind-jarring remembrances of stuff that we said or did 2 years ago that I'm clueless. I have no idea.
Yeah, well, and I will say, Adam, the rare listener and rare member of our Facebook group that ask intelligent questions. Did I just say that? Yes, I did. But anyway, so Adam asked about the Two Live Crew trial. I will say I was not the clerk for that trial. The trial was held in front of boy, do I have stories about this woman, the Honorable June Loran Johnson, who is no longer with us, in courtroom 354 at the old wing of the Broward County Courthouse. It was a cause celeb, as their album, I believe it was called Nasty As I Want to Be. And it was a huge media event. As I said, I did not sit in on the trial. As I recall, they were found not guilty of obscenity, because that's such a broad standard under U.S. law and under the First Amendment and stuff like that. But it brought back memories of June Loran Johnson, the judge that presided over the case. And wow, before I get to June Loran Johnson and the stories I have about her, I was trying to remember what were the biggest media circuses in the 33 years I was at the courthouse. And I think in no particular order, we had the Anna Nicole Smith adoption issue, where the judge, Larry Seidlin, famously said, "You got to do right by the kid." Remember that, Barry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then we had, of course, the Two Live Crew trial. And then we had the Kathy Willits trial. Do you remember the name Kathy Willits?
Oh, Jeff, do I? Jeff, I've seen the video that
okay.
she So, yeah, so, Kathy I remember Willits. Kathy and John extremely well.
Kathy Willits was a woman in Broward County. She was actually married to a Broward sheriff's deputy. And her defense, she was charged, what was it, with, I don't know if it was with prostitution or something like that. But she famously used the nymphomania defense. She and her husband had this, some sort of marital game they played, where she would get men to come over and basically fuck her. And her husband would sit in the closet videotaping it and getting his jollies. After the man left and was done screwing his wife, she and her husband would have sex. And that was like the way they got off. And so they ended up getting charged. The guy that was the prosecutor ended up becoming a judge in Broward County because of the notoriety. But I'll never forget standing outside. I was on a break when Kathy and her husband were coming into the courthouse. And the media stampede, the media with the camera crews, the newspaper reporters taking photos, they literally trample people to get a shot or a video of Kathy and her husband. She had the huge store-bought boobs. I remember that because here she was going to trial for this thing, and she's wearing this extra tight dress with the boobs in full plumage, waiting to be seen by everybody. And wow, that's just a crazy courthouse memory. Yeah, those would be, I remember this is going way back to right before or right about the time I started going was the case of, God, I just can't remember the guy's name. He was an older guy that was convicted of the murder of his wife. Do you remember when Dr. Kevorkian was like all in the news and he had the machine that would assist you in committing suicide? You remember that, Barry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure.
And the guy was brought on trial. It was in Broward County, was brought on trial because his wife, I don't know if she had Alzheimer's or dementia or some sort of disease that was a fatal disease that she was just going to die from in a slow, maybe it was cancer. She was going to die a slow, horrible death from. And he assisted his wife in basically committing suicide. And they brought him to trial and they ended up making a movie. I remember because they were filming the movie right after I started working there, and Eddie Albert from Green Acres played the defense attorney. But anyway, enough about that. Let's get back to June Loran Johnson, who presided over the two live crew trial. June Loran Johnson was a county court judge for, I want to say, about 15 years. And she was like an ex-hippie. She was a really nice lady, first of all, because she was one of these people. I had this special gift when I worked at the courthouse. Not everybody has it, where I can joke with somebody about something seemingly serious, and they don't take it, you know, they don't take it seriously, you know. And I really look upon it as a gift that I can, you know, basically give people some shit, but in a joking way. And like I used to do it with my supervisors, and they don't take it like, you know, like I'm being a smart ass, even though I am, but they don't take it like being disrespectful. They understand that I'm joking about it. And so we had a lot of fun sitting in her courtroom. Now, that being said, she would set court appearances for like arraignments and stuff like that at 7:30 in the morning. Okay. Well, like I said, she was an ex-hippie, so she wasn't getting up at no 7:30 in the morning. So she would literally come in at 10 o'clock. So the people in her courtroom would be sitting there for a good 2.5 hours. So, you know, when people are sitting there for 2.5 hours waiting for their court case to be heard and the judge hasn't shown up yet, yeah, people tend to get a little bit fussy. So June Loran, as we used to call her, would come in. Now, Barry, I'm not kidding. We're talking F, maybe G. She was a Zoptic woman, okay? She wasn't extreme. It wasn't like she was 350 pounds. She was a normal-sized woman that just had enormous breasts, okay?
Okay.
Doesn't make her a bad person. And she literally would come and sit on the bench, and people, I'm not kidding you, she would flop her boobs on the table as she took the bench. And it would make an audible plop as her boobs would hit the bench, okay? And she would start calling cases. And as the day would start wearing on, she would kind of start leaning back a little bit, okay? Well, she was, you know, she would wear skirts or dresses. Now, what I'm about to tell you is 100% accurate. I'm not lying. You're not going to believe me, but it's true. She would sit there and call a case up. John Smith, please step forward. And the person would come step in front of the bench. You are charged with disorderly conduct. How do you plead? As the person was entering their plea, addressing the judge, she would then lean over, which she had on the bench, and she would take her bottle or can, Barry, of FDS, do a little quick spritz down below, and then take the plea.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not even kidding, people. It was fascinating to watch. That's all I can say.
It's something to watch, yeah.
Yeah, it was. And she had these two guys. This was, of course, when in the late 80s, you know, the war on drugs had been declared and all that. So anybody that came into court with a DUI or a possession of marijuana, of course, they wanted to know if there was a problem. Okay, so she had these two guys that ran a, I don't know if it was a DUI school or a drug rehabilitation school. It was Bernie and George. I'll never forget. And every person that was charged with DUI, how do you plead? Not guilty. Bernie, George. And she would have these two guys go over, and they literally would walk up to you and go, and they'd start smelling your breath. I smell alcohol, Judge. 6 weeks of treatment. And she would order immediately order you to begin going to treatment with these two guys, because they were absolutely sure that they smelled some sort of alcohol in your breath. Everybody who had a DUI, who pled not guilty, went to treatment with Bernie and George, who, by the way, eventually both were arrested, I believe, for bringing drugs into the country. But that's another story for another time. One of the other stories I remember about Judge June Johnson was when this was a time when domestic violence was unfortunately not treated as seriously as it is now, because, of course, the majority of courthouses in this country, county courthouses, most of them usually have a domestic violence unit or a domestic violence component, where, because these are such specialized cases and where, you know, people don't want to testify, you know, because, of course, you're looking at breakup of marriages and stuff like that. It's very sad and very tragic. But anyway, this was still part of regular county court. And so we would have a guy. I remember we had a guy come up once. You're charged with battery. How do you plead? And the guy said, not guilty. Okay. Now, let's remember, everybody charged with a crime in this country, Barry, has a presumption of innocence, correct?
That's what they say. Yep.
Okay. So what she would do was she would say, is the victim here? And then, of course, you see a woman in the back wave her hand. She would then direct her bailiff to take the defendant into the jury room. By the way, that's completely inappropriate, by the way. And go sit in the jury room. I want to talk to the victim. The victim would then come up to the podium. She would then lean into the microphone and go, he's pled not guilty. And the lady, I remember, said, well, yeah, he didn't do this. Okay, well, maybe he didn't. Presumed innocent. She leans into the microphone and goes, how can you let him do this to you? Don't you know this is going to happen again? Completely inappropriate. Okay. But this was part of the story that was June Johnson there. You know, people talk about whether the court system is better or worse than today. I will tell you this, folks, you don't get characters like June Loran Johnson in courts anymore. And, you know, because of social media, there was no social media when June Johnson was on the bench. I will tell you, and this is a hilarious story, the way that June Johnson, she ended up being removed from the bench. She had what was known in our office as the bag of files, because what she would do is she would try to negotiate pleas with defense attorneys. And so what she would do is she would go down to the clerk's office. She would grab like about 25 or 50 files. She would put them in a bag. She would go up on the bench. She'd call the defense attorney and say, you got a driver's license suspension here. If I offer you withheld in court costs, you're going to plead this out? Yeah, okay. So what would happen is she would keep the files under her bench on the, you know, up on the, in the courtroom. So when it came time to do a case count, which the clerk's office was required to do every month, she would have a low case count because those files that were in the bag under her bench were, of course, not included in the case count. So Judge Johnson always had one of the lower case counts in county court. So what ended up happening was, so Barry, back in the day, if you were to get a DUI, of course, that would never happen because you'd never do that. Traditionally speaking, what would happen is on a first DUI, you would get 6 months probation. You would have to go to a registered DUI school in the area. You would get a 6 months DL suspension with a work permit. You'd have to do 50 hours community service. You were usually ordered that you have no intoxicants, so you couldn't drink or anything like that for the 6 month period. You were always tested monthly to make sure that you weren't a bad boy or girl. And, you know, there may have been a few other things, but that was the basic thing. Well, the idea that June Johnson came up with that eventually led to her removal from the bench was, if you came into court and at arraignment, instead of pleading not guilty, she reset your arraignment. You, of course, waive speedy trial. She reset your arraignment for 6 months down the road. You did all the things you had to do that were required by state statute. You did a period of probation. You did community service. You did the school, et cetera, that I just mentioned. When you came into court in 6 months, there'd be no license suspension, Bear. So you wouldn't have to go through that waiting period of getting a work permit and all that. Well, by the way, that's completely against the state statute and the law. So what happened is at some point, and it had been a while, the state attorney's office got wind of this. And I know that a few state attorneys that apparently had gone along with this. And I say that, you know, it's very hard as an attorney in a division, if a judge tells you to do something, to say, no, judge, I'm not going to do that and not get in hot water. But, you know, that being said, so eventually the state attorney gets wind of this, files a complaint with the Judicial Qualifying Committee, and June Loran Johnson ends up getting removed from the bench for doing something that was completely inappropriate. But I will say, wow, June Loran Johnson, thanks for the memories, because she was this crazed ex-hippie on the bench in Broward County, Florida, and Fort Lauderdale. And I just had tons of story and tons of fun in her courtroom. She was wacky, but she was a super nice lady. And I raised an adult beverage to her memory, Barry.
Any idea what she's doing now?
No, she's deceased. So she's not doing much.
She's dead. Well, there you go. So there'll be no spritzing down south. what you were saying. All right.
We'll have no more of that, unfortunately. So June won't be doing one of those for the memories, you know. Now let's go to the other question that Adam, I believe it's pronounced Dumau. If I mispronounced it, Adam, I apologize. So what Adam posted, as Barry mentioned, was Adam had been going through particularly our list of the top 100 matches that we did probably in the first, 40 or 50 episodes of this show, Bear. And he's going back and looking at some of the matches. And let me just say, for anyone listening, and I reached out to John McAdam, and John didn't know this, but if anyone knows of a full copy of the 1983 June 83 match between Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee, the hair versus hair match, if anyone has a full copy of that match, please post it in our group and let Adam know, because Adam is really searching for that. I searched, and I think there's a copy of their match from, I want to say, the late 70s that I remember was the first match that Scott Bowden ever went to that got him hooked on Memphis wrestling, the late Scott Bowden. And I know they have a really, really strong match from late 1985. That's the one where Dundee's wife had her head shaved, I think.
Yeah.
So we're looking for this one from June of 83, the full match, Lawler versus Dundee, hair versus hair. So he also, and what I thought I'd do was, he makes some comments, and I thought we would just kind of shoot the breeze, our remembrance of these matches. September 2nd, 1982, Satoru Sayama versus Dynamite Kid. He says, wow, a young Bret Hart in the corner of the Dynamite Kid. Japanese announcers talk as fast as the Japanese wrestlers move in the ring. How many Tiger masks were there? First of all, I believe the number is 4. I know we had Satoru Sayama and we had Mitsuhiro Misawa. There were 2 others. Afterwards, he asked if one of them was Rocky Romero. I don't think that was the case, Barry.
Wasn't Koji Kanemoto also
a... Yes, he might have been one, too.
Right.
So he says, but I don't think Rocky Romero was one.
Doesn't ring a bell.
He says, the power of the Dynamite Kid is amazing. Tiger Mask bouncing off the mats when he's body slammed or just thrown down on the mat is something you do not see these days. What a backflip of Dynamite by Tiger right on top of the fans in the first 3 rows. Looks like he actually hurt the women in the front row. First of all, you can't go wrong with Siam and Dynamite Kid. Pretty much any match that you could pick out. There's was great, the one from Madison Square Garden. I think the one from April of 1983, which was one of the last matches they had together in New Japan, that was the famous match where Dynamite broke the bottle after he'd gotten thrown out of the ring, was one of my, I want to say that was one of my top 5 of the 80s. So I hope if you get a chance, you'll reach out and find that one. I want to say right off the top of my head, April 9th, 1983. Wow, I have no idea why I remember. You know, I can't remember what I did yesterday, but I can remember shit that the Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask did. Friggin', 37 years ago. The next match he talked about, Barry, and boy, when I look back on his remembrance of this match, I want to say that this should have been a top 20 match at the very least. Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood versus Don Cornelius and Sergeant Slaughter. I want to say this was late April 1983. This is, of course, famously remembered as the night that shut down Greensboro, North Carolina, because the traffic jam was so long. Barry, I know you remember this match.
Yeah, we reviewed this too. This had to be one of the first 10 or 20 episodes when we did. And I think the real takeaway from this match more than anything else, the match is very good. And it shut down Greensboro. The way that the fans were so vested into this match and that really, what a difference that can make when fans believe, when fans at every single movement, fans were popping. That match was so exciting.
Yeah. And I remember a couple things from this match. I remember Don Kernodle walking to the cage and the woman at ringside, or maybe it was a younger woman, just screaming at him at the top of her lungs. And I'm sure obscenities and stuff like that. And I know that Bruce Mitchell and John Hitchcock, Oban Johnson, guys that I consider the real gatekeepers, along with the guys from Mid-Atlantic Gateway, may I say, of Mid-Atlantic history, remember this match as being what it was, which was so great. So Adam's comments were, strange hearing the Rocky theme played for Kernodle and Slaughter's interest while they're getting booed. Why is Sandy Scott, the referee for the match, being announced as the great? What made him so great? Sandy Scott was a huge babyface in the 60s and early 70s with his brother George. They were a huge, huge babyface team in that area. So he was a real big deal years before.
Great Scott! But that's exactly what a lot of it was. It was the right. It was the old nickname of Great Scott. I mean, Sandy was always good. Sandy was the guy that worked for Jim Cornette, right? And Smoky Mountain.
Exactly. Yeah. You're right. Was there ever a time when Steamboat was not a great wrestler? The answer to that is no.
Absolutely.
I think he was a great wrestler from day one. Holy cow, did Slaughter actually just jump off the top of the cage? The early 80s, Sergeant Slaughter was absolutely a bump-taking machine. He took some of the wildest bumps. That bump that he did against the Iron Sheik and I think Pat Patterson, where he gets thrown into the corner, jumps over the turnbuckle and posts himself and then goes down to the floor, was absolutely amazing. He mentions also always loved when other wrestlers would come out and congratulate new champions. I know that's something they did when Flair won the NWA strap. That's something they did in CWF when Dusty won the world title from Harley Race, I want to say in 79. So, yeah, that was really cool. One of the things he talks about with the Lawler and Dundee video that's out there, which, as he says, is only like a 2 or 3 minute clip, was they did a really awesome montage set to the theme of Rocky. And he reminded me, Barry, that at this match, heels and babyfaces both sitting at ringside to indicate just how important this match was. And I remember that. That was a really cool little added thing. And as he said, it adds to the magnitude of the match. And that was a nice
smart to do that.
Yeah. It's a nice little touch. Next, he says, April 3rd, 1983, Tatsumi Fujinami versus Riki Choshu. This, of course, was part of the famous Ishigun versus Seikigun feud that was in New Japan, as Riki Choshu was one of the real first Native American heels that got over. I mean, like super, super hot, because he got so hot in his feud with Fujinami that New Japan started moving away from the traditional Japan versus United States main events. I mean, they still kept that to a certain degree, but this was the first Japan versus Japan feud that really got over, I think, with the Japanese fans and New Japan especially. He did not think this was a top 100 match and asked, you know, what was it that made this particular match so special? You know, quite honestly, with the benefit of 30 plus years of hindsight, did they have a better match? I mean, it's quite possible, but this was really a legendary feud. I'm sure that I wanted to include this feud because it was such a big deal at the time. And there were so many great moments in this feud. Could I have maybe picked a match from later in the, you know, this year or, you know, before Choshu jumped to All Japan a couple years later? Maybe. But, you know, I wanted to represent the feud in some way. Maybe you have a point. Maybe there was a better match, singles match. Tons of great tag matches between Choshu and his guys, Yatsu and Animal Hamaguchi versus Fujinami, Kimura, and Mighty. I know there's a six-man match out there between those six guys that's tremendous that could have been on there. So that's a match to look for, Adam. Fujinami, Kengo Kimura, and Akira Maeda versus Riki Choshu, Animal Hamaguchi, and Yoshiaki Yatsu. That's out there somewhere. See if you can find that on Daily Motion. That's a match to look for. He says, was there legit heat between Fujinami and Choshu after the match? No, these are two great professionals working the crowd, essentially, because these guys made tons of money with one another. And, you know, even if they did dislike one another, guys that disliked each other knew enough and were smart enough to put aside personal animosity and were able to create money with one another. There's lots of instances of that happening, right, Barry?
How smart were these guys that they were able to do it, that 30-something years later, somebody's questioning, was this legit? Was there heat between these guys? Yeah. That's fucking successful right there.
Yeah, and I can't recommend enough. Whether you are just looking up stuff on YouTube or Daily Motion, the stuff with Ishigun and Seikigun from this time period is just so, oh my God, it's so incredible. The crowd, again, there we talk about the crowd being invested in everything. The crowd completely believed and was completely invested in it.
Yeah, that's the way it should be. That's it. Again, you can, I think you can take a match that is average at best, and if the crowd is through the roof, you can make it a 4 or 5 star match just based off of the crowd reactions.
Absolutely. Okay, Barry. So Adam, thanks again for the question and the comments. We appreciate it. You know, we always appreciate people on our board trying to be interactive with us and stuff like that. So if anybody else besides Adam decides to go through and look at some of the stuff that we've talked about, matches we've talked about. I was trying to think the other Lucha match that we did, Barry, that we talked about. I'm going to draw a complete blank on the guys' names now. It was the hair versus hair match where the woman was sopping up the guy's blood.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't remember what the match was, but I remember that.
Yeah. And that was like from 1984 or something like that. I'm sure somebody will remind us on the group. But, you know, so if somebody else goes through and looks at some of the matches that we talked, especially my top 100. By the way, Adam, it was my top 100, even though you gave Barry credit for it. I'm sure he appreciates that. Yeah, absolutely. So if anybody else wants to do that and mention our matches, give their opinions and what they thought about it, we're happy to discuss, you know, going back and looking at some of the stuff we've done in the past, because we are 146 episodes in, Barry. Can you freaking believe that?
No, I absolutely can't believe it.
So as the time we tape this, which is a Saturday afternoon, Barry, I am especially looking forward to, and I'm going to have the DVR working overtime because, of course, Sunday nights are Perry Mason and I'll Be Gone in the Dark on HBO. But on TNT, Barry, I don't know if you watched season one of this show, even though I pushed it through the roof. They are starting season two on TNT of The Alienist. And it's a completely fascinating series that is set in turn of the century, 1900s, New York, and involves detective work by an alienist, which is that's what they called psychologists back then, Bear. And I think Dakota Fanning is in it. And a couple other well-known, the guy that played the lead role in the Hobbit series. God, I can't believe
Elijah Wood.
No, not that guy. That was the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Oh, okay. It's just a Hobbit. He played the head dwarf or whatever. His name is Richard something. But anyway,
dwarf.
The Alienist.
Really, I know. But when you say head dwarf, all of a sudden, you know what I'm picturing, right?
So. Exactly. Yeah. Of course. You have to be into the genre.
Exactly.
I was watching Jeopardy the other night, and Alex Trebek was saying there's like YouTube clips of him saying the word genre. And like people put in like 2 minutes worth of Alex Trebek saying the word genre. So anyway, on behalf of Barry and behalf of our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, who is, by the way, at this very moment, searching for restaurants in San Francisco to recommend to one of our other readers on our Facebook page. Folks, we will talk to you next week. Go out there and search for some Lucha Libre, because I'm sure Roy Lucier can recommend some good stuff. And we thank Roy once again. And we'll talk to you next week, folks.
Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.